So we'll just kind of slide through the rest of these. Ron the Bullfrog, American Bullfrog. Historically, its distribution ran up the eastern part of the United States into Canada, down into the southeast, and basically ended in the southeast in the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, and maybe a little bit over into Louisiana and Texas. But the bullfrog's been introduced throughout the United States and is actually, and really throughout the world. We'll talk more about invasive species, but this species is the one that's raised for frog legs in aquaculture facilities around the world. There are actually places that buy bullfrogs from us, raise them outside the country, and then ship the legs back to us for consumption. I have some stats on that. It's pretty amazing. You'd never think we eat that many frog legs, but we do. And a pretty major issue, too, because this is not only an aggressive animal, but it appears that it probably has a pretty strong immune system. And it can be sublethally infected with pathogens that it could then shed and release into naive environments, naive populations, and result in population declines. At least that's the going hypothesis right now. And we're actually doing a little bit of testing with that with frog virus 3. All right, so anyways, that's another lecture. But this is this is the American bullfrog, Rana catspiana, or catspiana. And the characteristics of this this ranid are, first of all, the mid-dorsal lateral folds that you would normally see come down the side. I'm trying to get my laser pointer going here so I can point there. There we go. Right here, that you would come down, that would come down the side for a lot of the ranids. Actually wraps around the tympanum here. So there are that it's actually just wrapped around the tympanum. It doesn't continue down the body. So that's one characteristic. You're probably only going to get this confused with potentially the green frog, and that's the easiest thing to look at. If you're looking at a brownish greenish frog and it looks large, it looks like either a green frog or a bullfrog, look at that mid at dorsal lateral fold coming down the back. Okay. What else? Yeah, well, okay, there you go. Just as far as this is true with, I think, most ranids. I won't say that. With some of the ranids, the tympanum is a way that you can actually sex the individual externally. For males, the tympanum is larger than the eye, and then females, it's about the same size or smaller. So what does that look like to y'all? Male or female? Female, yeah, that's what I would guess too. All right, so remember that. I'll probably ask you to do a male-female type identification with, you know, either a green frog or a bullfrog. Okay, they are summer breeders. They're breeding out there with a bunch of species. We'll actually talk about the seasonal progression of our anurans here in Tennessee later, in a couple slides. So they're summer breeders. They are the largest frog, the largest anuran in Tennessee, and they are pretty voracious. They'll pretty much eat anything they can fit in their mouth. I've got a pretty neat picture at the very end of a bullfrog eating something very large. That's often true with pretty much any frog. Well, not any. Okay, we'll talk about the funny thing about there's always exceptions in ecology, and we'll talk about some different frogs, actually, hopefully in this lecture, that have different mouth apparatuses or feed a little bit differently. But for in general, most frogs will eat anything they can get in their darn mouth. And so their gape size pretty much dictates what they eat and what they can eat. All right. This, I don't know if you've ever picked up a bullfrog, but it'll just kind of go paralyzed. Sometimes it's obviously a predator defense type mechanism where they play dead, and hopefully that loses the interest of a predator. And anyways, if you've ever done that and you're like, oh man, what did? I crush this thing, and you set it down, you wait there for a second, that thing will all of a sudden be gone. I mean, and they can leak pretty good. Okay. Its call is one that you've more than likely have heard in the summer in Tennessee and elsewhere. Where is it? Ah, right there. And I can't really think of anything else that sounds like that, as far as our frogs go. Oh, what was that? Oh, we haven't gotten to that frog yet, or have we? Oh, no, we don't think we have. There's one in the background. What is that in the background? They're out there calling with them often. That's what I do here. Okay. Anyways, there's a green frog in the background. All right. So as far as you can see their distribution throughout our country, and pretty much everywhere except up in the mountains. Well, they've actually been introduced into some ponds up in the mountains, but pretty much, eastern United States, and they've been introduced throughout the coastal western United States. They're throughout our state. And anyways, they like more permanent wetlands and emergent wetlands, the EM up there. But usually ones that have a longer hydro period, because their larvae usually need to develop for a longer period of time. Well, usually more than one growing season. Okay. All right. So they've been, eastern United States introduced in the western United States wide here. All right, what else? I guess that's it. Okay, here's the thing, the other anuran that you may get it confused with, the green frog. Also very common in our state. all right, hey, based on the tympanum, what would you guys say? What's that? Male, yeah, good one. Mm-hmm. There's some other characteristics you can look at just in general for other types of anurans that we'll talk about later. Certainly a vocal sac for a lot of them, and during the breeding season they also have characteristics that you can use for identification of males. They're hormonal based. So green frogs, don't be too, misled by green. They're normally green, all right, but they can certainly be brown, like this one here. This is actually a metamorph, and the metamorphs are almost always brown, but it may get more of a greener color later on, but you can see adults that are certainly brown. Again, what you're looking at here, characteristics, is that dorsal lateral fold that comes down there, and you can see it extends past the tympanum. And the other characteristic, yeah, I forgot about that, you can look at it, is in the center of the tympanum there, it's raised, okay? And that becomes more apparent later in life, although you can kind of see it there. I don't know, with the metamorphs, Liz, did you ever really see that very much? Yeah, not very often, so. Okay. So there's your ridge, and then there's the tympanum. I guess that's what I'm pointing at. All right. Oh, same characteristic. Again, they're out there breeding generally the same time as bullfrogs are, and prefer similar habitats, relatively emergent wetlands with decently long hydro period, although their tadpole certainly can develop within 1 year, but they will also overwinter. And they have a very neat call, and it's very diagnostic. It kind of sounds like a banjo string being plucked. So. All right. Let's see. Oh, some folks get the green frog, they're called confused with the barking tree frog, but so just make that note as you're learning them and go back and listen to them, compare them. But this, they are quite different, and this is a much lower kind of tonk than what you would hear from a barking tree frog. Okay. All right. Again, eastern United States is its distribution throughout our state. It's common, although we've done some very interesting studies with comparing these guys with the bullfrogs, and it appears that they don't necessarily have as strong of an immune system, probably, than the American bullfrog. And incidence of prevalence of FE3 in green frogs was much higher in wetlands where they were stressed than with bullfrogs. Bullfrogs had a lower prevalence of frog virus 3. Again, we'll talk about some of that stuff later. But anyways, let's see here. Oh, that was it, basically, okay? So, green frogs. Oh, you know, I haven't pointed out this link here. This is the Austin Peay State University. They are in charge of all of the herpetofaunal records in the state, and that link takes you to an electronic version of this, the Atlas of Amphibians in Tennessee, and they're working on reptiles right now, which should be out, who knows, next couple of years. That's what Dr. Scott was saying, but that's what we're all hoping. Anyways, so that's online. It's a good reference, and although they really, I don't know how often they update. Well, I know they're always updating their database, but I'm not sure of the information on the website. And certainly this, I think, was published, in the 90s. Okay. All right. There are a lot, you know, we're just, again, TAMP has been, Tennessee Amphibian Monitoring Program has been kind of instrumental in helping increase our understanding of the distribution of these different inurns throughout Tennessee. And there are still a lot of county records, a lot of counties that, like, for example, there's no records of green frog in those counties. Well, that's probably because nobody's listening down there, very likely. Anyways, we're building that knowledge base. The pickerel frog, Rana palustris. Okay, when you're looking at that thing, these guys are a little bit smaller than green frogs, and green frogs are generally smaller than bullfrogs. Obviously, what jumps out at you here? Yeah, the spots, right? There's really only one other frog that's probably going to get you confused, and that's the next one. It's the southern leopard frog. But the spots on the pickerel frog are very, they're actually paired. They're square and they're paired, and they go down the back, go down dorsally, in a very regular pattern. The other thing is that with the southern leopard frog, which you'll see, is that on the tympanum, they'll have a white spot, and the pickerel frog does not. Okay? So you have paired squared blocks as opposed to round spots. It'll be kind of irregular with the southern leopard frog. And there's no white spot on the tympanum with the pickerel. They're about the same size, and their breeding certainly overlaps. Okay, they're breeding early, April-ish. Okay, they kind of a snore, and it, to me it sounds like you're opening a creaky door. Okay, now we have other species that kind of do a snore. The crawfish frog and the gopher frog. And so make sure that you make a note of that and compare them. They are quite different. This is a much higher call than either of those two species. Okay. And the crawfish frog. And we can compare those here in just a second if you would like. So what are we doing? Pick a roll. Okay. Okay, let's compare that to the crawfish frog, which is very deep. Come. Okay. And the gopher frog. This one, remember I mentioned, sounds like a woodpecker. It's kind of fast. Okay, so you're snoring frogs. All right. Okay, let's see here. Distribution statewide. And eastern United States, I guess it's less common, at least so as we've documented in West Tennessee. And emergent wetlands, they're out there with green frogs. Although they'll certainly breed in wetlands that have a shorter hydro period. Their larvae will develop within a year.
I'd hate to say exactly. Probably what, three months, 4 months, Liz?
3 to 4 months, larvae of pickerel frogs can go. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe even a little less, yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I mean, this is what the literature says. they prefer cool water with high water quality, but, you know, that's not necessarily the case. I mean, maybe that is the case throughout some of their range, or maybe most of their range, but I haven't really observed that personally. Maybe y'all have, but anyways, you'll read that in some of the guides. Okay, so the southern leopard frog, which does look similar to the pickerel frog, except that it has those spots up there, but you can see how they're smaller, they're round, and they're not paired. They're very regularly shaped, etc. And there is that white spot in the tympanum, which is unique for this species. Okay. All right. Let's see. There we go. Breeding season. February, March, maybe a little bit earlier than the pickerel, but their breeding seasons certainly overlap. okay, yeah, their call is a series of clucks or chuckles, and they also do some groans that you'll hear intermixed with those clucks. That sounds like you're rubbing your hands over a balloon, like, okay? And that'll really kind of be a good key, because its call does sound similar to another species. Okay, and that's going to sound similar to the wood frog, which is next. But it won't have that rubbing. All right. So that's southern leopard frog. And they're located throughout the southeastern United States. Overlap with the northern leopard frog in the northern part of its region, or of its range. And statewide, it's not that common though in the Smokies. Let's see. Oh yeah, they're real good swimmers, and they'll often, instead of jumping away, they'll swim away from predators under the water. Although all the ranids are very good jumpers. Okay. Let's see, emergent wetlands, they're out there with the other ranids. Okay. There we go. Wood frog. I think this may be our last species. This is one of our earliest breeding species as well. You often, they'll be out there with the southern chorus frog and the spring peeper. The characteristic here that's pretty diagnostic is that dark mask behind the eye. Okay? That dark mask. Do you remember what other species in Tennessee has kind of a dark mask? But it's a lot smaller. Yeah, the mountain chorus. Mountain chorus frog. Okay. But this is certainly, you know, has that ranid type body feature. It has dorsal lateral folds, and it has, it's a lot larger. What else does it have? Oh, the mountain chorus has patterns on the back. Remember, backward parenthesis type patterns that sometimes look like backward parentheses, but it has patterns on the back where generally your wood frogs don't have much patterning or spotting or anything like that. White upper lip. Again, early breeders, and as their name implies, they like forested wetlands. Yeah, they're often out there, well, you know, if we got ice, but where you do get ice, and we, of course, we certainly get ice some years, and up at higher elevations, they'll be right out there, even getting ready to go as things start warming up and the ice is just thawing. Okay. One thing about their embryos that's kind of unique is they have bicolored embryos. And if you're looking at it, the embryo from above, it's black, and on the bottom, it's white. So it's a bicolored embryo. Unfortunately, you really you just see the tops of them. But if you looked underneath, you would see the white. Okay. And this call is similar to what we just listened to. It's a series of clucks or chuckles, but it's kind of interspersed with a different type of grunt, not that rubbing that you hear, like a balloon. Now, for those that waterfowl hunt, to me, or our birders, this really sounds like a mallard with doing a food chuckle when they're feeding. And if you know what that sounds like, to me, that's really... It's just a sound that I'm familiar with, but okay. Wood frog. Oops. There we go. Now, the one thing is, generally you're not going to hear wood frogs with southern leopards, although you could, you certainly could. I shouldn't just say it. I mean, you certainly could. But in most cases, you aren't. But these guys are going to breed a little bit earlier, and they're generally going to be associated with forested wetlands, although we'll certainly get into emergent wetlands that are shallow. Okay. And that is in comparison to that. Okay. To me, it really, if you are listening, you can almost listen to the wood frog by itself and be like, darn, is that a southern leopard? But if you hear a southern leopard and you hear that grunt that the southern leopard makes, you're like, oh, hell, that's a southern leopard. So just keep that in your memory, that if you're confused, probably go with the wood frog, because that's probably what it is. And the southern leopard, I think it's very diagnostic. It's low grunt. Okay. So that kind of wraps that up. Any questions? I think that was the last one. I guess I probably have some other slides here. Oh, I forgot the distribution. Sorry, y'all. So mostly forested wetlands, mostly in the eastern part of our state. And they are a northeastern species, certainly going down into Appalachia, southern Appalachia. Okay, so, but they do overlap with southern leopards. With respect to seasonal trends of species occurrence in our state, I kind of put them all together on one slide so we could think about them. So in January, our earliest breeders are the southern chorus frog, and in fact, I've already heard some out there. In February, we can start to hear wood frogs, spring peepers, and gopher frogs if you're in the western, well, no. If you hear a gopher frog, you let everybody know. Again, we've only had one record of that in the state, but towards the south, okay, the gopher frogs, like in Mississippi and stuff, will start calling in February, early breeders as well. March, American toad, southern leopard frogs, crawfish frog in West Tennessee, okay, start up. April, pickerel frogs and mountain chorus frogs. Again, chorus frogs, just really because they're at higher elevation here and things generally warm up later. The mountain chorus can breed earlier if it's warm enough, but often, just because it's generally colder at higher elevations, they're almost always found above, I can't remember, I think it was 1,000 meters. So anyways, April generally, and the pickerel frogs are starting up about then. And then May, you know, things are warming up, everybody's kind of waking up, you know, from maybe a long hibernation and coming out of the ground or out of burrows or out of wherever, out of trees. And you have the fowler's toad, northern cricket frog, gray tree frogs, and bird voice tree frog. And again, bird voice is primarily a western Tennessee anurin. June, July, so our summer, we have generally the most number of species out there. The green frog, American bullfrog, southern cricket frog, northern was actually up in May, but anyways, your cricket frogs, eastern narrow-mouthed toad or eastern narrow-mouthed frog, eastern spadefoot, barking tree frog, green tree frog. Okay. And really anything is possible August through December. You'll get, especially your colder breeding species, you know, like your southern leopard frogs out there, even calling in the fall sometimes. And if they can get a responsive female that may have not bred or may, most anurans generally just breed, the females release one clutch of eggs. However, it has been documented in some species multiple clutches. At any rate, you may hear some in the fall and some breeding going on, but it's certainly not
concentrated like it is in the spring and in the summer. So, okay? Cool. Some helpful sites here, which y'all, all this stuff is on the internet, or on the internet, on the web page. So, let's see. Oh, yeah, so, do y'all want to practice? let's go ahead and practice, and then after we get done practicing here, we'll take a break. And as you're taking a break, I have some video of calling frogs. And the website to I found a really good website. It's like MidwestFrogs.com or something like that. And they have some great video of the frogs calling, and it really helps when you see these frogs calling, and then you hear it. It helps you actually visualize the sound. So the next time you hear the call, you almost visualize what the frog's doing. And each of them, it's pretty neat. I don't have them for all of our species, but some of them I'll just play them while we're taking a little break. So let's go ahead and, you can take out a piece of paper here and let's write them down so that everybody really kind of, this is a learning exercise, right? Yeah, where's our high school teacher, right? Everybody take out a piece of paper. Pop quiz. You ever do that, Trent?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's look at, y'all look at that and write down what you think it's going to be. And if you want, I can make another one of these up, like right before the exam, too, for you guys to practice. Or y'all can make them up for each other and quiz each other. Okay, so that's the first one. And like during the quiz or whatever, I'll give you like 30 seconds or something. I don't know, a minute to look at it. That's the second one. Of course, you can just write down whatever you feel comfortable writing down at this point. Yeah, but you will need to know both common and scientific name, be able to spell them correctly. That's the third one. Number four. One thing about knowing the genus and species, if you at least put down the genera, I'll end up giving you partial credit, because that's at least demonstrating that you can put it into a genus, and you won't get full credit, but all right, so you certainly should be able to put that thing into a genus if you don't know the species. Fifth one. Number six. Okay. Number seven. Number eight. number 9. And I think we have one more, number 10. What is it eating?
Yeah.
It's a fish. Okay. So, number 1, what was it?
Green
frog. Number 2. What's that? Pickerel. Yep. 3. Wood frog. 4. Mountain chorus. 5. Eastern spadefoot. 6. Spring peeper. 7. American toad. Yep. Now, you can see the number of dots here, number of warts, okay, are at the most 2 per dark spot. Okay, it'd be more for the fowlers. Plus, it's a lot of times it's hard to see the parotid glands, but they're not touching the cranial crest. 8. What was that? A little bit of confusion. Southern leopard frog is one choice. What's another choice? Yeah, the crawfish frog. Yeah, it's the crawfish frog. The crawfish frog, remember, has the white encircling the dark spots. Southern leopard also doesn't have that many spots on it, just dorsally. Maybe, yeah, it does have some spots on the side, but the crawfish frog is completely covered in spots, and those spots are encircled. With the gopher frog, they're not encircled, and actually, if you're able to see underneath here, the crawfish frog has a nice white, chin area, and cream ventral side, as opposed to the gopher frog, which has some spots. What's that?
Barking tree frog.
Yeah, that's barking tree frog. So what could we get that confused with? Green tree frog. What does the green tree frog have that would make it diagnostic? Yep, that's one characteristic. It less granulated skin compared to the barking tree frog. And it has that nice, really large white cream line that comes mid-laterally. Okay. And look at that dorsal lateral fold going around the tympanum. I don't know where that bullfrog is from. And the common name is technically American bullfrog. That's obviously in a zoo someplace. They've sat around and that bullfrog's gotten pretty hefty. I did have some calls, but I don't know if y'all want to practice that or not, or if you want to take a break. You want to do a few calls, maybe not 10, just a few? Okay, let's do a few. All right, here we go. Number 1. It's that loudest one that keeps repeating. That one there. Okay, that's 1. Number 2.
like they're vomiting, I swear. Okay. All right. Number three. Number four. And we'll just do one more here. That one right down two species. Did you hear the other one? Yeah, at the very end. You could hear them actually off in the background, but you know, a lot of times that's how it is when you're out there listening. You can just hear something kind of faintly out there. Okay, so number one, what'd y'all call? Yeah, the green tree frog, like the bicycle horn. Number two, what was that? Fowlers. Number three. Yeah, northern cricket, that Geiger counter, start slow, get fast, go slow again. Whereas the southern cricket is much more almost single-noted, and it's pretty constant. Next one. Yeah, that chuckle with the balloon rubbing at the end. And the fifth? The bird voice and the green frog. That's correct. Okay, good job, y'all. All right, let's take about a 10-minute break. I'll put on some video and see if y'all can just kind of relax here. All right, hello, hello, hello. All right, we're back online. Okay, so this next lecture is really geared towards talking about what an amphibian is, first of all. There are certainly characteristics that put organisms into the class amphibia. And our extant amphibians, the taxonomy of our extant amphibians down to basically going through all the families that exist currently. And some evolution, and we won't get to evolution today, and my description of evolution will be very general because I'm not an evolutionary biologist, but the readings that you have, one of your readings in here that from Zug's book that will provide a good background, and we'll touch on some of those points. I think I have a couple pages also from, actually, here. Couple pages here from Dulman and Troube. They have an entire chapter on origin of amphibians and evolution, and it is way too long and tons of detail. So really just focus on those, six, seven, eight pages in Dulman and Troube in that handout that I gave you. Okay, so anyways, the goal is what I just said, pretty much to get you all familiar with the class of amphibia, the diversity of the extant amphibians, and some of the characteristics of those families. And then we'll talk really about just the fossil record. There's a lot of debate
weather of weather amphibians came from one origin or from multiple origins, multiple organisms, I should say. Anyways, I'll leave that just for your reading. So we'll primarily focus on fossil records of amphibians and when they showed up with respect to geologic time. Okay. Anyways, so that's the order we will go in, and we probably will not get through or get to number three, to the fossil record aspects. All right, so what are amphibians? We're actually going to go through six very key characteristics on the next slide, but you might be able to sort of sum this up in saying they're exothermic tetrapods that have a biphasic life cycle, okay, meaning they have an egg life cycle, often aquatic, not always, and they have anamniotic eggs, and which are often, but they're not always. I mean, the thing about amphibians is, as Dr. Echternot mentioned, is this is a transitional, vertebrate class, so to speak, and in between full terrestrial organisms and aquatic organisms. And the interesting thing is they've tried a lot of different things, and so they almost are very rarely ever absolutes in this class. So this is just a general definition, and with the key being generally a biphasic life cycle and anamniotic eggs. This is the typical reproductive life cycle that the very first one that, again, you were taught in biology that Dr. Echternot talked about, and then he had seven more life cycles he went through, where you have eggs released and external fertilization. There are some cases where there is internal fertilization. We'll highlight those as we go through the taxa. And then those eggs develop into, are fertilized, the embryos develop, the eggs hatch, and you have a free-living tadpole out in an aquatic environment, and then it goes through metamorphosis and becomes a terrestrial adult. And that's the typical life cycle, but there are certainly a lot of different life cycles, which was last lecture. Okay, we are in the kingdom Animalia. Chordata is the phylum, and we're in the vertebrate subphylum, Vertebrata, class Amphibia, and then we are in the subclass Lys Amphibia, which are considered the modern amphibians, basically not the extant amphibians, or the extinct amphibians. Amphibians comes from the Greek word amphibios, and meaning double life, biphasic life cycle. And we are going to consider that, well, the subclass is Lys Amphibia, okay, regardless of its ancestral direction of, or lineage of the different orders. Okay, the orders are Anura, Caudata, and Gymnophiona. And so we have the frogs and the Anurans, the caudates, which are the salamanders, and then the Sicilians, which are in Gymnophiona. Okay? And that's where we are in the animal kingdom. All right? Okay. Any questions? Again, you can print PDFs of these lectures off. They're on the website. I try to get them up. I got this one up actually today about 1 or 2. I try to get them up earlier. Amphibian characteristics. All right. There are six of them that we'll talk about. And these six and a couple other characteristics, I believe, are outlined in this handout that's in Zug's book. And it's the one that has the table of all, well, actually most of the families of amphibians. Okay, so you have the
Sicilians and the Salamanders on that in that first table, and then you have your Nern families on the second table, and it, then it talks about basically characteristics of amphibia, okay, the current, the modern amphibians. And we'll highlight some of those here. Not all of the these tables are not inclusive, okay? You'll notice that there are additional families, I guess most current taxonomic breakdown, well, mostly the most current taxonomic breakdown of families. There are more families I'll present than what's in Zug's book, is what I'm saying. Okay, the first thing is that all amphibians have the capability of cutaneous respiration. Okay, they can breathe through their skin, and in other words, oxygen can diffuse through their skin, and they respire that way. And some taxa are extremely efficient at this. Other taxa use it less or use it more on a seasonal basis, for example, when they're hibernating or estivating, and use, you know, typical bronchial pharyngeal respiration other times of the year. So cutaneous respiration, both oxygen and CO2 transfer. One thing that makes amphibians very susceptible to anthropogenic stressors, contamination, things like that, is because they have this skin that allows transport of various chemicals, really not just oxygen and CO2, across the epidermis. And in order for efficient oxygen transfer to the blood supply, whether it is your lungs or whether it's their skin, in order for that to happen, it needs to remain moist. Those surfaces need to remain moist to allow efficient oxygen transfer. So that is another thing. There are amphibians that are in xeric environments, but there are none that live in the Sahara Desert, okay? So they do need to stay moist, and again, we'll talk about adaptations with respect to post-metamorphic survival and estivation and various things that some of these taxa do that are pretty awesome to survive dry conditions, but they need to keep their skin moist. Okay, the plethodontids. The plethodontid salamanders, which are actually the most diverse salamanders, have the most number of species. The lungless salamanders they don't have lungs, so they rely solely on cutaneous respiration. We'll talk about the plethodontids in a bit. And generally, as far as other modes of respiration, generally the larvae, certainly free-swimming larvae, have gills, and they may be, well, most, as far as tadpole larvae, they're internal gills. Salamanders are generally external gills. And then the adults have two lungs, although in some species one lung is very reduced. But they always have two lungs, if they have lungs, okay? All right, second characteristic, they have two types of skin glands, which we've already talked about. Well, I guess we just talked about one of them. One of those skin glands is related directly to keeping the skin moist, and those are mucus glands, and that assist in cutaneous respiration. Amphibians also seek out certainly moist conditions to help keep their skin moist, facilitate that those moist conditions. Okay, there are also glandular glands which produce toxic secretions, and depending on the species, there may be very few, and in other species, there are a lot of glandular glands, and that certainly helps in predator defense. Often the glandular glands are, but not always, located up towards the anterior portion on the dorsal side. Mucus glands are located on the entire body, generally dorsally though, but on the entire dorsal surface. Okay. The parotid glands, which we've talked about, are really just glandular glands, but they're in high concentration, and those are very, well, those are apparent in, well, at least most of the toads, most of the true toads in the family Bufonidae. Okay. I'm sure there's an exception because there's only like 400 and some species of true toads. They can be, depending on the species. The Sonoran toad can kill a dog. But generally, like the American toads are not toxic enough. In the family Dendrobatidae, the poison arrow frogs, their skin glands are highly toxic, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. But their glands aren't nearly as apparent as what you see in the big parotid glands of bufos. Okay. Let's see here. Oh yeah, their ears, and that's one of the readings in here, one of the pages, just like about a paragraph or two. They have two auditory channels, whereas all other tetrapods have one channel for hearing. And that is the columella basilar papilla. Okay, so the columella channel is what it's called. The columella channel is what in the middle ear is what all their tetrapods have, and of course we do too, and that's for picking up airborne sound, okay? But they also have an opercular channel, and that opercular channel is actually picks up lower vibration sounds as far as frequency, and it is transmitted through the pelvic bone, okay? And you can read about the details of that in the handout too, because the auditory, that's on the other side of the handout about the ears, but the next one actually is about the eyes. We haven't gotten there. So they have two channels. That's the key thing, and remember, it's the columella and the opercular channels. And the opercular channel the columella channel is not present in all amphibians. In fact, it is absent it's definitely absent in salamanders. And they just rely on the opercular channel. And it's got to be, and also in Sicilians. Anybody have any personal knowledge of that? Okay. I'm pretty much, your neurons are the ones that really are listening to auditory sound, and pretty much your salamanders, I know, well, the salamanders definitely, and I'm pretty much sure the Sicilians are just opercular. I may have that on another slide. Okay. So tympanum is the eardrum, right? Okay. The eardrum of the middle ear. And there really isn't an outer ear for amphibians like we have. They technically call like this fold of skin that comes around the tympanum the outer ear. All right. And then they all have an inner ear. Okay. All right. So that's the ear, and that's unique. This is also unique for amphibians, all amphibians except for Sicilians, and that is green rods in the retina. Okay? There are no other tetrapods that have that capability, that have green rods. In fact, we don't even really know what they do. It has to do something, obviously, with picking up different types of light, but we haven't figured out what. Other light receptors, red rods, like us, single and double cones. So their eyes are large, and they can see pretty well. Well, for the most part. Certainly there are some amphibians that
have degenerate eyes like the Sicilians. Okay. The other thing is they have bicuspid pedicellate teeth. Bicuspid pedicellate teeth. So bicuspid, right, two cusp, like here. And they're pedicellate, all right. So the gum is right here and the crown. And their teeth will wear down and the crown will break off and a new crown will form out of the pedicel, which is connected to the jawbone and is the living portion of the tooth. Okay? Maybe that is it. I don't think I have room for another characteristic down there. Five characteristics, I believe. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So there you go. There's five characteristics. There are a couple more which you can read in that handout. All right? So it being a graduate class, of course, it's more like, you know, tell me about some things that make amphibians amphibians. That's the question. obviously, it'll be type of question. It'll be more scientifically or written, but at the same time, graduate type questions are more conceptual based, not conceptual, but at least comprehensively based. All right, just to try to give you some thoughts and hints of as we're going through here. All right, modern orders of amphibians. Okay, I already mentioned the Gymnophiona. We have our caudates, and we have our anurans. Now, how many species of amphibians have? Okay, I'll give you a benchmark. We have around 6,000 species of amphibians in the world. Okay, what's the most speciose out of those three orders? In fact, I think we already touched on it. Yeah, the anurans, the frogs. And there are around 5,000 there. The least speciose, the Sicilians. And then intermediate are the caudates. Sicilians, there are 167. Currently described species, those species delineations change all the time because taxonomists have to have a job. In fact, somebody would disagree there's 167, but there are about 160, 170, depending on how you want to break your species out. Okay, there are 559 caudates, species of caudates, and then the majority are frogs. Are the anurans. Okay? In fact, you break it down here and it looks like this with the pie chart. 88% of the amphibians out there are anurans. Now, that doesn't mean that's the case in our state. In fact, it isn't. In our state, around 70% are salamanders, 30% are anurans. In fact, yeah, we have 80, well, again, folks will debate about whether we have 86 species or less than 86. This is the most that we have. And it may be more like 80, depending on how you break things out. But 86 species in the state of Tennessee, of which 60, right around 62, I think, are salamanders. Remaining portion, well, we have 21 anurans, so subtract 21 from there, that is 65. Okay, 65 salamanders. So about 70% of our species are salamanders in the state. Our salamanders in the state of Tennessee. In the United States, the figure of 240 to 280, again, depending on the way you break things out and molecular type things and all that stuff, around 280 species in the United States and Canada, I should say, north of Mexico. So when we look at this, we have around 6,000 species in the world, right? And 280 are here in, you know, the United States and Canada, so we really don't contribute a whole lot to global diversity, but we certainly have some very unique species, and again, the amphibians are, as a class, we'll talk about even more, as we're already hitting on, they are an important
group of vertebrates that are certainly sensitive to changes in aquatic and terrestrial environments and are good indicator species. So most of the species richness of amphibians is tropical, and most of them are the frogs. You'll get a feel for that as we go through each of the families, because we'll actually start off with a lot of things up here in the temperate regions, but when we hit the anurans, which is the last order we go through, there are a lot that are tropical. Okay, so the Caecilians here, some characteristics of the order Gymnophiona. First, they're limbless, okay? They do not have a pectoral or a pelvic girdle, okay? They are limbless. They look like an earthworm. We'll get to that, actually. I think that's a characteristic now. They have degenerate eyes, and remember, they don't have the green rods either, okay? And the reason they have degenerate eyes is that most are fossorial. In fact, they're the ones that really are not that fossorial really are always on the ground and kind of digging in and out generally. But some will be completely fossorial, and then there's some variation. Okay, Caecilian comes from, I'm not sure the what that word is from. Sacus, but it means blind. So that's where Caecilian comes from. Anybody know what language? I don't know it might be Latin, but I don't know. Anyways, the primary mode or the mode of reproduction is internal fertilization with Caecilians. Okay, all of them have internal fertilization. The phallodium is a copulatory organ that we will actually talk about when we talk about courtship and mating. But they use that. The males actually insert that into the cloaca of the female for about 2 to 3 hours and fertilize the eggs. But it's not a true penis. Okay. Most of them are viviparous, okay, live bearing young. And the remaining are oviparous, okay, which is the typical. I mean, that really includes all egg-bearing, right? Egg-bearing organisms, but that's means the typical life cycle where you have a free-living larvae, okay? They are earthworm-like, and they vary in size from being relatively small to being pretty large, a meter and a half. Okay, they have tropical distribution. You aren't going to find any Caecilians except in a pet store here. So they have tropical distribution. And there are 6 families of Caecilians. All right. The first are the common Caecilians, Caecilidae. They are the most speciose, and when we go through each of these orders, we'll start with the most common, we'll go to the most rare, okay? And there are 95 species of Caecilians in this order, which accounts for 57% of the species in the order. They have primary annuli, which are these circular segments. Just like an earthworm, they are segmentated. And they have primary annuli. Now, those primary annuli, they all have annuli. That actually should be really a characteristic up here. They are all segmented, but those primary annuli, depending on the species, may have what are called secondary and tertiary grooves, additional grooves in the annuli. And a description of that is in your reading, just to provide some details, okay? So it is kind of a way to help differentiate between the families. Because there are only six families, I'll probably give some characteristics and expect you to be able to provide the, at least pick from a list or something like that, the correct family. So these characteristics I kind of expect you to know in detail. As we get to the salamanders and the frogs, because there are so many families, I kind of present more interesting life history stuff as opposed to really a lot of details that are for comparative purposes because, anyways, all right. They're mostly fossorial, and they have no true tail. And the reason that that's there is because some of them do have a true tail, which means they have caudal bones and they have muscles that operate those caudal bones. All right, their skull is, all right, who's the mammalogist in here? Stegocrotaphic. Does that sound about right? All right. What that means is, in fact, there's an explanation of it right here. You can look at this handout, is that it is a completely, the skull doesn't have any holes in it in the top, okay? It's a completely formed skull. There are no holes in the top. Stegocrotaphic. That's my best guess at how to pronounce it. Does that sound worth a darn? Okay. All right. The next order, Ichthyophidae, is the fish Sicilians. And there are 38 species, which accounts for 23% of the species in this order. They have primary annuli with secondary and tertiary grooves. And they do have a true tail. Okay? It is short in all these. It's not like a, you know, dog or anything. Or a kangaroo. And they have the skull, the completely formed skull. Well, they actually are eating inverts in the soil, and they're more probably like a mole than a snake or a salamander, which tend to be, you know, more active predators. Yeah. Okay. Oops, I'm sorry. Any questions there? It's related to the number of grooves, and you have a reading on that. And basically what you need to remember is, well, read up on the difference in the grooves. You have your primary annuli, which are these main grooves, and then in between those grooves you can have additional grooves, secondary and tertiary. And based on that, you can tell the difference between, you can break these families into groups at least. Ones that just have primary annuli and ones that have primary annuli with these secondary and tertiary grooves. Okay? But it has to do with these with their segments. Now, just in general, you can kind of see the difference here. There's a heck of a lot more grooves here than there are with this family. And you can kind of think in that capacity. Okay? All right. Good? The next family is the aquatic caecilians. So as you mentioned, they're primarily aquatic. Okay, there's 14 species in this family, 8% of the species. They just have primary annuli, and they have no true tail. Now there's the different skull type, zygocrotaphic. And that means that there are openings in the top of the skull, whereas with the stegocrotaphic, there are no openings in the top. Okay? Let's see, and these guys are strongly aquatic. All the species primarily are in water. They're very almost eel-like. I don't have a picture of these guys, the beaked caecilians, Rhina tremadidae, 9 species, so only 5% of species for the order. And they have the primary annuli, but with in addition the secondary and the tertiary grooves. They do have a true tail. And again, they have the zygocrotaphic skull. All right, the tropical caecilians, scoliae comorphidae. 6 species here, so around 4% of the species in the order. Primary annuli only, no true tail. Zygocrotaphic skull. And they do have vestigial scales, in the most posterior annuli. Okay, so that very last annuli, they actually have these vestigial scales, which is unique. This is the only family that has that. Okay. The last ones, the Indian caecilians. Uraeotyphilidae, and there are 5 species in this family. And this particular family has the primary annuli, but only secondary grooves. They don't have tertiary grooves. They do have a true tail, and they have the stegocrotaphic skull. Okay, so I know that's kind of a lot of details there, and that's just primarily because when it comes down to telling the differences in these things, you really have to look at those fine details. And since we're only dealing with 6 families, when you look over these, you'll see that there are things that separate each one of the families. And so that's the Gymnophiona. And I guess we're already out of time again. So we will finish here, then we'll start with the salamanders on Thursday and go over the inurn families and hopefully get through all those and also get through a little bit of the fossil record. All right, you guys got any questions? You know, Pat, that's a great question. You know, I don't know how many of these families actually overlap with their ranges. I think a lot of them are very range specific, and there isn't a whole lot of overlap, quite frankly. But, you know, when it comes down to the species within these families, now that might, you might need to do some type of X-ring. I'm not quite sure. To be frank with you, I know very little about Sicilians, except what we have here. I'll find out for you, okay? All right. Any other questions?